105. Newark, New Jersey. 3 days later. How's your ass?
Better than your colon, Zig teased, limping into the pale beige hospital room. The bullet that tore through Roddy's stomach had also perforated his bowel, forcing the trauma surgeons to sew a colostomy bag to the left of his belly button. Only for a month, they promised. Same amount of time, his right arm would be in a cast. At least I don't smell, Roddy said, as the antiseptic and metallic stench of Silvadine burn cream filled the room. When the freezer exploded, Zig was lucky he was running, though he still took the brunt of it. Full thickness burns, third degree, across his neck and back. Hair burned away, leaving the back of his head a mess of uneven patches. Plus bits of metal shrapnel, glass, and razor-sharp slivers of freezer door that lodged into his posterior thighs and rear end. The only unscathed part was the top of his left shoulder, from where he was carrying Reagan, whose body they never found in the rubble. Zig's doctors kept him for days to make sure there was no infection, but from the ginger way he was walking, full recovery would take weeks.
I heard you're leaving, Roddy said, using the elbow of his cast to push the button and raise his hospital bed.
Who told you that?
Josephine, the nurse. She's chatty.
Plus, the clothes are kinda a giveaway, Roddy added, pointing to the khakis and polo shirt that Zig was wearing. Both bulged at the back from the thick gauze underneath. And, you know, Roddy added, pointing to the half a dozen Mylar balloons Zig was holding. All the pity presents.
They're not pity.
You earned them, Zig said, tying the balloons to the foot of Roddy's bed. Wags had sent them to Zig, but for 3 days now, Roddy's room had been empty. No flowers, no cards, nothing.
You're a good person, Mr. Zig. Though I need to know, were you always coming in to say goodbye? Or only because you heard the FBI was here?
Come on. What kind of monster you think I am? After a pause, he added, though, how'd you know I knew about the FBI?
Josephine.
She said you gave her $20 for a list of everyone who came to visit me. She really is chatty, isn't she?
Her brother and dad are both police. It's in her blood. Also, you're a mortician.
No one likes morticians, Roddy said, glancing up at Jeopardy on the muted TV.
That's a joke, Mr. Zig.
I could tell, Zig said with a laugh. But if we can get back to your visit with the FBI?
They found the money Elijah stole. The $22 million. Most of it, surprisingly, still there, split among bank accounts in the Philippines, Burma, and the usual Caribbean islands. His lawyer's trying to make a deal, but the prosecutors aren't having it, Roddy explained. What's interesting, though, is they finally got into Mint's Black House account. His bank accounts, too. Elijah didn't make a single payment to Archie Mint or Rashida Robinson.
So that money Mint was getting, those $9,500 and $8,500 payments,
Mint was paying himself for months now, selling stocks, cashing in bonds, even took an early withdrawal from his 401k.
Zig nodded, putting the final pieces together. Mint was getting ready to leave his wife.
It happens in marriages every damn day, raiding the family's accounts. So when he started the divorce, he'd have money put away for his new life.
Does Tessa know?
She does now.
Zig nodded.
Since the moment they learned about Grandma's pantry, they'd been convinced that the key to the case was figuring out who took the $22 million.
OJ thought the same, which explained why he and his Dover crew came racing to the crime scene, took over the investigation, and tried to keep things quiet. But as OJ and Zig now understood, Mint's murder had no connection to Grandma's pantry. They were two totally separate incidents. That is, except for the fact that Mint and Rashida were sleeping together then, and clearly sleeping together now. In fact, when it came right down to it, the real reason OJ's forensic reports had made no mention of Rashida being in the car, well, It was no different than what motivated Mint's son in the first place. It wasn't some grand government scheme, but something personal and private, an infidelity that was about to tear the Mint family apart. In the end, OJ was simply trying to be a loyal friend, hiding Mint's second phone and Rashida's location in hopes of sparing his family the embarrassment of finding out that Mint was again cheating on his wife. "You can be a great soldier and still be a bad husband," Zig finally said. "Mm-hmm," Roddy agreed, glancing over at Zig, then back up to Jeopardy. "That's not really news to you, is it? The details about Mint's accounts, his divorce. Let me guess. Your friend in the bureau, Wags, she already told you what was going on. Roddy, did she tell you about the drug boss Zion worked for? Adrian Vess. Apparently, he's the one who hired the Reds to kill Zion. He didn't care about Mint. He just didn't like Zion freelancing, and even more, was worried about his empire crumbling if Zion ever got nabbed. Interestingly, a few days back, Vess was rushed to the emergency room, said some berserker woman shot him in the foot and leg. Guy has nerve, though. He spends a decade shoveling drugs to kids, then files a police report. Says that when he got back to his office, one of his paintings was missing. Zig couldn't help but grin. "Wags told you that too?" Roddy said. "She was just, I'd like to know what you're really doing here, Mr. Zig." A daily double came up on screen. "I told you. I came to say goodbye," Zig said, running his hand along the length of one of the balloon strings. "Nola," Roddy said. "It always goes back to Nola for you, doesn't it? You think I'm still looking for her, aren't you?" Roddy liked that about Zig, always working the case. "Roddy, if the agents told you something, a few days back, they found an address. You have to understand, the Bureau doesn't care about Nola. Once they realized she didn't take the money, she became inconsequential. But not to you. Or to you. What did you do with her address, Roddy?"
"I called in a favor. One of our dispatcher's stepsisters is a Pennsylvania detective. She and her partner went for a look.
Please don't tell me they tried to confront her."
"Nola was living in an RV, an old Airstream trailer in some kind of botanical garden. By the time they got there, Nola was gone, the place empty. They think she had a cat, though that was gone too. From what they could tell, she cleared out in a hurry."
Zig exhaled loudly.
"Of course she did. Mr. Zig, I'm the reason she ran."
"You don't know that."
"I don't blame her. When we were little, I was a shit to her. And not just to her. To everyone."
"Roddy,
do you think people are capable of change?"
"Let's not get overdramatic.
You were there. You saw me these past few days," Roddy said, his voice picking up speed. "You saw me lose my temper, the way I unleashed on Seabass. Did you know I broke my hand? Fractured my knuckle from hitting him so much in the face. I even came after you. In Elijah's bar, I wanted to..." He stopped. "How can I be a good person if I still keep reverting to that old version of myself? It's like Mint. You can do all these good things, but no matter how good it looks on the outside, there's still something rotten lurking under the surface."
"Roddy, you're not like Mint."
"We're all like Mint."
"We're not," Zig insisted. "Everyone keeps a side of themselves slightly hidden, tucked away from the world."
"You don't?"
"My wife didn't talk to me for 3 years. She probably still shouldn't. But for some people, in this case for Nola, things just move slower than you want. But remember what you asked me when we were headed to Elijah's? Who are you at your core? The answer doesn't come from a single moment, and it certainly doesn't come from a third party.
She's my twin sister. I don't care if she's Mother Teresa. The definition of you does not come from someone else, especially her. I mean it. You don't need Nola Brown to figure out who you are. You saved my life twice, Roddy, at risk to your own. You're a good cop, and a good person as well. Roddy cocked his head, looking unconvinced. There's a saying, Roddy. If gold rusts, then what can iron do? I'm not sure what that means. Are you saying I'm iron? We're all iron. And in those rare moments when we're gold, even then, we're not perfect. We're all a mess of failures and good intentions. Cut yourself some slack. When Nola's ready, she'll come around. She's never coming around. You're right. She may never come around, Zig agreed. But trust me on this. When it comes to forgiveness, you can't give it to anyone until you give it to yourself. Roddy said, letting Zig's words roll through his brain, still staring up at Jeopardy. I like that iron and gold part. You get that from Facebook? The Canterbury Tales. It's like the original Facebook, but with paper. And actual wisdom, Zig said, patting Roddy on the shoulder like he was getting ready to leave. You know, Mr. Zig, there's still one last thing I don't understand. About the case? About Nola, Roddy said, glancing over at Zig, watching his reaction, noticing Zig was now the one locked on Jeopardy. Back when Mint first got shot, Nola rushed to the scene instantly, and she stayed committed to the case. That's a really good friend, don't you think? I'm not sure what you're getting at. Just asking an honest question. When this started, I assumed Nola had a personal stake, that she was worried for her own life, or that something bad from her past was about to come out. But in the end, the reason she put herself at risk, it was just her friendship with Mint? That's why she was so concerned with everything? Looks like that to me. And your friend Wags agrees. She didn't tell you something different? Zig stood there, the balloons swaying slightly next to him. That's all I know, Roddy. Though as far as I can tell, no one's really an expert on Nola. For half a second, Roddy sat there, tempted to say something, but instead went with, "You're probably right." Up on the TV, one of the contestants punched the air, celebrating his correct answer for the second daily double. "No sponge baths today, no matter how many times you ask," a nurse named Jerika announced, shoving open the door. She was wiry, with wide eyes, a warm smile, and stray gray hairs like veins. "Listen, I should get running," Zig said, spotting her rolling cart, which held a pink plastic basin filled with soapy water. "Time to change the colostomy bag." "I'll speak to you later in the week," Zig added, heading for the door and flashing a thumbs up. Roddy gave his own thumbs up, but he knew the truth. "You have a good life," he thought as the door slowly shut and Zig disappeared. "Aw, sweetie, someone sent you balloons," Nurse Jerika said. "Those from your sis?" Roddy sat up straight. "How'd you—" "Downstairs, at the check-in desk. They only give info to family, but as I passed, I heard this woman say she was your sis," Jerika explained, circling to the other side of the bed, dragging her cart behind her. Along the wall, she gave a pump to the hand sanitizer, quickly cleaning her hands. "I gotta admit, she's like a clone of you, sweetie." "Was she? What else did she say?" "Typical sibling. Wanted to know how you were, when you're getting out. And this was just now? An hour ago. Maybe a little less. Call downstairs. Gino spoke to her. But take it from me. I'm fluent in pushy family." "She's worried about you," Jerika teased, sliding on latex gloves and letting them snap like she was ready for surgery. "Come on, let's get you clean." Lifting the side of his gown, Roddy revealed the beige plastic bag attached to his belly. There was a stab of pain as she pressed the skin around the stoma, the fresh, tender hole, and freed the currant bag, which had a pungent smell. To reassure him, Nurse Jerika gently put her palm on his forearm. But at that exact moment, if she looked up, she wouldn't see pain or even embarrassment on Roddy's face. Instead, she'd see a lopsided but unmistakably wide grin. Nola was here. Only for a few minutes. But she was actually here. She's worried about you. That's something, Roddy thought.
106.
I really have to ride in this? Zig asked. Hector, the orderly, nodded, pointing Zig to the wheelchair, in no mood for a fight.
Hospital policy. What if I promise not to sue? Those are always the people who sue, said Hector, a burly man with a bushy beard and a rainbow-striped button on his lapel that read, Sounds gay, I'm in. Don't worry, your manhood will survive. It's not my manhood I'm worried about. Oh,
actually, maybe it is,
Zig said, gingerly lowering himself into the wheelchair. Between the burns and the shrapnel, sitting wasn't easy.
Just promise me there are no potholes. It's Newark, sir.
There are always potholes, the orderly said, pushing him up the hallway to the nearby elevator. A minute later, there was a ping, the doors opening on the ground floor.
You got a ride? The orderly asked.
Uber, Zig said, pulling out his phone to...
I got him, a female voice announced.
Zig looked up. Halfway down the polished hallway, she stood there alone, near the wall, like the last stubborn bowling pin refusing to fall. In the fluorescent light, she looked washed out and tired. But even from here, her dark eyes were knives.
Nola.
That your daughter? The orderly asked. Zig shook his head, blinking, like he still wasn't sure she was really there.
What are you doing? He asked with a glance. It's a 2-hour ride.
Uber's a ripoff, Nola said. Let's go. I'm double parked.
Not bad advice, the orderly agreed. Anyway, on behalf of the city of Newark and our general counsel, you are officially no longer our legal responsibility. Also, don't trip on the speed bumps outside.
Standing from the wheelchair, Zig was working hard to hide how much it hurt. Not that Nola was looking. She was already outside, the revolving door still spinning as he followed her to her car, a beat-up gray Dodge with a dented roof that looked like it had been repainted by hand. As Zig tugged open the car door, he saw that the floor was littered with fast food wrappers, styrofoam coffee cups, and a swirl of plastic supermarket bags. Cat hair was sprinkled across the passenger seat, along with what looked like the top from a stick of deodorant. Nola wasn't just driving this car. She was living in it. Sliding inside, Zig gripped the doorframe tightly, holding his breath to hide the fact that his legs and back were on fire.
You're in pain. I'm sorry about that, Nola said.
I'm fine.
You smell like Silvadine. That's burn cream.
The back of your hair is burned away.
She waited for Zig to say something, but all he did was fidget with the cap from the deodorant. Shaking her head, Nola hit the gas, pulling out of the hospital roundabout.
Stop trying to fix everything. It's why you frustrate people, Mr. Zigarowski.
Then I guess I'm on brand.
Leaving the hospital behind, Nola made a quick left onto Bergen Street, which was buried in a snarl of traffic. Up ahead, past the IHOP and KFC, a city worker in a cherry picker had his crane extended up to a broken traffic light. A motorcycle cop stood at the intersection, doing his best to direct the crush of lunchtime pedestrians and honking cars.
Something tells me people in Newark aren't good at taking turns, Zig said. Nola didn't even grin. Her jaw was clenched as she gripped the steering wheel like she was strangling it.
Nola, I really do appreciate the ride,
but I'm assuming you came here for more than just, I didn't know about Elijah. Zig turned, confused.
Elijah?
Why would...
Last time I saw you. At the funeral home, in the shower. You told me you were headed to see Elijah, to ask him about Grandma's pantry, Nola said,
still staring straight ahead. But I'd never. If I knew Elijah was the one who stole the money all those years ago, I would have stopped you. When I heard the Reds were that close, I tried calling you. I wouldn't let you walk into danger like that. In front of them, the traffic had barely moved, extending half the block. Nola was still murdering the steering wheel. And that's what's been weighing on you? Zig asked. That you weren't able to figure out all by yourself the case that stumped everyone for over half a decade? You don't understand. I went to see him. When Mint and Rashida were killed, Elijah was one of my first stops. Even back in the day, he was top of the suspect list. Always a self-promoter, but smart. Didn't spend his money for years. Had a good alibi with his brother-in-law for funding his stupid bar. So when you said you were going to see him? Nola stopped, eyes locked on the cherry picker. I'm sorry you got hurt. Ms. Wags showed me the reports. Third-degree burns. I shouldn't have let you go there. Zig sat in silence, staring down at the deodorant cap like it was a manuscript of ancient wisdom. You done? I don't want to hear your stupid lectures. It's not a lecture, Nola. I appreciate better than nearly anyone what a powerful narcotic guilt is. And I know it's even more potent when you think I jumped into this case because of you. So let me just say it. I'm a grown man. When it came to Mint's case, I was the mortician of record. The only reason OJ brought you in was to get to you. I'm well aware. But that doesn't change one immutable fact. This case smelled from the start. That's why, at the funeral, I followed the family into the gym. Whether you showed up or not, I would have looked into Mint's death. No, you wouldn't. Zig thought about that, the car slowly inching forward. Maybe I wouldn't, but I'm glad I did. Nola turned to the words, annoyed. You're really such a softball. No, Nola. I'm a friend. Nola rolled her eyes as they approached the intersection. Slowly, KFC and IHOP gave way to mom and pops with dilapidated signs and metal bars across the windows. Laisha Africa Foods, Good Empire check cashing. Most of them were closed or boarded up. This part of the neighborhood clearly struggling. Still, on the corner, Zig spotted two Asian men, father and grandfather, each on their own ladder, hand-painting a royal blue awning with bright yellow letters. Sammy and Sons, plus a logo that looked like a wrench. A hardware store, Zig realized. Something new, even here. Nola, as a friend, can I give you a piece of advice? If I say no, will you listen? You don't like my advice, don't take it. But again, as a friend, have you thought about talking to your brother? Stop. Nola, stop. I need you to stop, Mr. Zigarowski. You think you know Roddy. I do. You don't. I can tell the two of you went through the grinder. You watched him get shot, and sure, that makes you feel bad. But that doesn't change who he is. Outside, the traffic cop blew his whistle, waving them forward. With a tug of the wheel, Nola made a sharp right and punched the gas, sending them screeching around the corner, the hardware store fading behind them. Nola, at the risk of sounding prehistoric, have you ever heard of Liberace? Famous piano guy. Matt Damon played him in that movie. Michael Douglas played him, but yes, the flamboyant piano player. Makes Elton John look like a yawn. Can you just skip to the inevitable moral lesson that you tack on at the end? We've got a 2-hour drive. It's either this or I can start retelling old Girl Scout stories from when you were little. Nola didn't answer. Zig was still playing with the deodorant cap, sticking his finger inside it, holding it up like a bobblehead. This is back in the 80s, Zig explained. To celebrate 50 years of entertaining. Liberace did 50 shows across the country, culminating with 2 solid weeks at Radio City, which is no small feat.
The first night at Radio City, he's sitting at the piano and starts telling the audience about this young couple who 50 years ago met at one of his very first shows. "And so, ladies and gentlemen," he says as the lights come up, "here they are now." Kazam! The spotlight swings, revealing this sweet elderly couple in the sixth row. Everyone starts clapping. People are crying. It's one of those touching human moments that lets every person in the room experience the power of true love. "But here's the thing," Zig quickly added. The next night, he tells a similar story of a couple that met at his show. "And here they are," he says, pointing to a different old couple. The next night, there's a third new elderly couple. And the night after that, the couples aren't real. "They're plants," Nola said. "Correct." This was before social media. No one was the wiser. It's a manipulative lie. No doubt. But every night, the audience ate it up, clapping, sobbing, leaving with tears in their eyes as they laced fingers with their loved ones, committed to being better people for just one night. Nola turned with a look of annoyance. "Liberace's a lying manipulator. No different than my brother. Maybe. When Liberace died, though, his finances were such a mess, they didn't even realize he'd spent his life giving over $6 million to fund scholarships for kids in the performing arts. Some of the endowments were permanent, and there were so many, even today, they still don't have an accurate count of how many kids he helped. That doesn't mean my brother's not a liar. I'm not saying it does. But we all have a person we were and a person we are. It's never a straight line between the two, and it's certainly never a predictable one. Just because you read the first few chapters doesn't mean you know everything that's coming. Keep an open mind. If you're lucky, there's a plot twist." With a thump, the car hit a pothole. A blaze of pain shot up Zig's back, but he never took his eyes off Nola. "Liberace still sounds like a pain in the rear," Nola said. "Thousands of old women in sequined headbands and multiple rings disagree with you." For a half second, Nola looked like she was about to smile. She didn't, but her hands did slide down the steering wheel to the 5 and 7 o'clock positions. The shift in her posture was enough that Zig spotted, in her door's storage well, a plain manila envelope. Squinting, Zig saw his name handwritten in black pen in the corner. "Nola, what's in the envelope?" "I'll show you after." "Show me now." On their right, they blew past a dilapidated red brick building, the roof sheared away, the zigzag of missing bricks resembling a crumbling smile. The place looked like it had been hit by a bomb. "It's about Maggie," she said. "Zig's daughter." "Nola, what did you do?" "Ms. Wags told me about the video. The one you were looking for. From the modeling agency. If you found something, a boyfriend. Liam Hudson. They called him Huddy. At least back then," Nola explained, eyes again straight ahead, hands back up to 10 and 2. "From what I could find, he was a new kid. Moved from Oregon. For some reason, everyone said he could do a lot of chin-ups. Did you know him, or just listen? He got there after I moved away. Apparently, at some point, Huddy asked Maggie out. They dated for a week or two. Then he dumped her for Daniela Moran, a nasty little panty stain who's now a corporate lawyer in Philly. That's why Maggie was crying in the video. Every week, the head of the modeling agency would do open mics, little interviews to give kids experience on camera, but really to get new signups. We'd never let Maggie sign up there. She didn't seem to care. She went with Daniela," Nola explained, handing him the envelope. "You'll see in the footage. Daniela goes first and mentions her new boyfriend. By the time Maggie gets on screen, the employee who's filming can tell something's wrong. He asks if she's okay, and the floodgates open about the breakup." Reaching into the envelope, Zig pulled out a DVD in a cracked jewel case. He was calm, which was the giveaway. You already knew, Nola said. Zig nodded, staring down at the DVD with a handwritten post-it labeled Superstars Modeling. Who told you? Ms. Wags? Nola asked. Zig nodded again. Though my ex-wife found it first, 2 days ago. Charmaine was smart. She remembered the old camera store in the same plaza, Camera World. That took her back to the source, the daughter whose parents used to run Superstars and started this whole mess. When Charmaine first spoke to her, the daughter said she'd already looked through all the videotapes. But when Charmaine called back, the answer was a simple question away. Among those old videos, do you happen to have a corresponding DVD? That was it. That's why the owners taped over the old video, Zig explained. Once they had the DVD, the original tapes went back in the camera. So you've already seen it. Zig nodded, eyes still locked on the DVD. Charmaine emailed it last night. It was 2 minutes and 23 seconds long. Maggie sitting on a sofa, wiping tears and snot on her sleeve as she told the story of how Huddy dumped her for Daniela, a detail that seemed to upset Maggie more than the actual breakup. Nola, do I even want to know how you got this? Zig asked, holding up the DVD. You don't. Zig laughed, tapping the jewel case like a drum against his own thigh. For years, just the sight of an old photo of Maggie, much less an actual video, would have ripped Zig apart. And sure enough, when he'd watched the video last night, hearing the story of her breakup with Huddy, Zig's eyes welled with tears. But they weren't tears of pain, or the even more ruthless tears of guilt for missing out on something as vital as his daughter's first boyfriend. To Zig's own surprise, it was actually nice. It was nice having something new. A little piece of his daughter that came back when he least expected it. It was good seeing her again, Zig admitted, though it wasn't until this moment, as he drummed the jewel case, that he realized the full extent of it. This DVD, everything on it. It was a gift from a ghost. A gift from the past. Wonderful, for sure, but not nearly as vital as something in the present. It was thoughtful of you to do this, Nola. You didn't have to. You're getting sappy, she warned. Of course he was, though he was done apologizing for it. All this time, Zig wasn't a broken man. He was a frozen man. 2 years ago, he'd taken the job at Kulta's funeral home to move on from Dover and dead soldiers, hoping it would help him come back to life. Yet it was time to admit, the only way to come back is to actually move forward. Otherwise, you just gather dust. By the way, not sure if you heard, but OJ offered me a job, Zig added. Wants me to leave the funeral home and come back to Dover. He said since we helped find the 22 million, he wants to bring me onto the investigative side. Have me look at bodies out in the field. Nola sat there silent, unreadable. Know what else I heard? Zig added. That he offered you a job as well. Who told you that? Ms. Wags? She said your work on the Mint case was exceptional. OJ's words, not just hers. And that he'd be lucky to have brains like you on his team. I'd rather have ants eat my eyes than work for him. So how do you really feel? Can you not be a sucker for once? OJ is, let me tee it up differently for you. If I was there and you were there, we could, don't even think it. I'm not saying I'm taking the job. But if I did, don't think it. Zig tapped the jewel case against his leg, letting the car fill with silence. What else did Ms. Wags tell you? Nola asked. Nothing. That was it. She glanced over at him, the two of them locking eyes. That was it, Zig said, holding up three fingers. Mr. Zigarowski, are you giving me the Boy Scout salute? Old habits, Zig said, starting to laugh and waiting for her to join in. She didn't. Heading under an overpass and onto Oriton Parkway, they blew past a wide building with boarded-up windows. Zig thought it was a factory, but it was really a school.
Nola, just think about the job, okay?
I'm not taking it. Zig started to say something, but stopped himself. In half a mile, the road veered again, through a toll booth that dumped them onto the Garden State Parkway. For the first minute or two, he searched the side of the road for green mile markers to see how far they were from home. What caught his eye, though, was a sign for something called the Midwood Diner. Next exit. Since his earliest days as a mortician, Zig knew that there are people you carry with you your entire life. They either help you or haunt you. But as the saying goes, you know you're on the right path when you stop looking back.
You hungry?
Zig asked. Nola thought about it.
I can eat.
107. 2 weeks later.
Close your eyes. They're closed, Zig insisted. Really closed. Not that fakery where you peek, Charmaine said. Like any ex-wife, she knew his tricks.
Char, why would I?
Look, closed. You happy? Zig asked, standing in the threshold of his front doorway. Outside, Charmaine was facing him, a big Lululemon bag at her side, resting on the doormat. As she opened it, Zig heard the jingling of the crystal and beaded bracelets on her wrist. Then a clink. Something glass.
On three, Charmaine said.
One, two, voila! From the bag, she pulled out a vintage Waterford crystal decanter, etched glass, sterling silver collar at the top. Zig's eyes went wide. Growing up, he'd spent every Sunday watching his grandfather fill it with cheap scotch, trying to make it look fancy.
Whoa!
Where'd you find it?
In my bar.
What are you talking about?
You stole it?
Don't pick a fight, Charmaine teased, her crow's feet deepening as she grinned. She looked stunning as the late summer sun waved goodbye to the sky, bathing her in golden light that made her green eyes glow.
I never stole it. You accidentally left it behind. I just decided it liked me better.
That sounds like kidnapping.
Think of it as me making it a better offer.
So, like the U.S. government with World War II Nazi scientists.
Personally, I tend to dial back Nazi metaphors, but if that's the hammer you need to make your point, so be it.
And you're welcome.
I refilled it.
She held up the crystal bottle. The liquid's pale bronze color gave it away. Balvenie, 25 years, single barrel. The one his grandfather always talked about but could never afford.
The last time Zig got a bottle was a wild night in Vegas that they'd never talked about since the divorce.
To top it off,
I pretend buy you those Winston Churchill lowball glasses that we should have bought in that antique shop in London.
Right there, Zig knew what to say. He had the perfect comeback on his tongue, loaded like a catapult, the retort that might make her blush, but would most likely make her lower her chin and cock her eyebrow in that way Zig could already feel in his pants. Charmaine took a half step closer, handing him the crystal decanter. The thin neck and wide bottom of the bottle had always reminded Zig of I Dream of Jeannie, but right now, as he reached for it, it looked like an oversized pawn. A light breeze blew through the porch, making the bamboo wind chime sway with a soothing timbre. Zig replayed his line again, but instead of cutting the catapult's rope, he holstered the comeback, putting it aside. Instead, he went with, "You're a good person, Charmaine. I pretend by you something really nice, too." Charmaine stood there a moment, her 11s shifting, like she expected something more, and was still waiting for it, even as she finally accepted that nothing more was coming.
She let go of the bottle as Zig gripped it with both hands. It was heavier than he remembered. By the way, I'm sorry things have been hard with you and Warren. He's still a good guy. Give him a chance. We'll work it out. Or we won't, she said, truly at peace, still standing there in the fading sun, looking as beautiful as he'd ever seen her, but also, in the subtle tilt of her head, looking sad. Years from now, Zig would remember this moment, remember this woman in his doorway, the sunlight on her cheeks, his fingertips anxiously tracing the etched patterns on this antique bottle. Over Charmaine's shoulder was her parked car, an old forest green Subaru covered in yoga and 26.2 marathon bumper stickers. Over Zig's shoulder was a quiet house. Most people think morticians are obsessed with death, or at least fascinated with it. For years, Zig's greatest fear was that death was all he was good at. Over time, especially lately, the universe seemed to be reminding him of that fact. But just being near Charmaine again, to feel the tug, the undertow of that old connection, just her smell of lavender and worn leather, nothing on this planet so instantly reminded him of one of the greatest, most rewarding things he'd ever accomplished. Like his old life was right there, waiting to be reclaimed. All he had to do was ask. Would it really be so bad to invite her inside? Zig held his breath. Leaning toward her, he gave her a quick hug, adding a pat on the back. It really was great seeing you again, Char. Lifting the crystal bottle, he added, thanks again for returning this to its rightful owner. Sure. No, of course. It was great seeing you too, Ziggy. Send my best to Warren, he added, rubbing the back of his head to feel the patches of missing hair. Before Charmaine could react, Zig closed the door. He loved her. He'd always love her. And maybe one day they'd give it a shot and try again. But not today. 5 minutes later, Zig was in his backyard, opening the roof of his hive, adding a fresh round of bee whiskey. I know, don't even say it, Zig said to his favorite girls. Thousands of bees sang back. You always liked her better. The bees agreed, sounding stronger than ever. You gotta admit, she looked gorgeous, right? Zig asked as he reached into the hive and pulled out a flat wooden frame. At the center of it was a smushed oval pattern, like a deflated basketball, a large cluster of larvae and eggs. Good sign. Lots of activity. As he pulled it closer, it wasn't hard to find the queen. He just looked for her attendants. A dozen bees, all of them pointing their heads toward her, grooming her, taking care of her, making sure she was safe. Queens weren't larger than other bees. Their giveaway was their shape, longer abdomen and legs, shorter wings. Plus, her back was bald and shiny. Looking good, Your Majesty, he said to Diana 28. Some queens were skittish. Diana 28 moved slowly, poised and proud. The hive was thriving. Sliding the wood frame back into place, Zig pulled out a different one. Similar oval, similar larvae and eggs. And yes, similar attendance. But at the center of this crowd, Diana 27, the old queen. Back on the night Zig got out of the hospital, he was ready to squish Diana 27. According to the experts, when you have two queens, it's the only way for the hive to survive. Kill one to save the other. Otherwise, they'll battle to the death, potentially killing both in the process. Game of Combs, one of the websites warned, Beemageddon. Yet on that night, when he opened the hive, to his surprise, the bees were doing well. Every hive had its own personality, and somehow, some way, this one decided to work it out. Diana 28 was on the first frame, Diana 27 on the back one. Not possible, Zig thought at the time. When he posted the details of his two-queen hive on a popular online bee forum, most people told him it wouldn't last, that he should still squish the old queen. But a woman in Massachusetts told him that while it was rare, her two queens had lived together for over a year. "Bees don't read the same books we do," she wrote. "You don't have to choose." Zig liked that. "Okay, see you tomorrow, kiddos," Zig said, sliding the wooden frame back into its slot and putting the cover back in place. The hive sang, already drunk on bee whiskey. When he was alone, Zig sometimes wondered what would have happened if he'd never met his wife, if they had never had a daughter. He'd play through the permutations, thinking how much easier his life would have been. In the end, though, even with the heartache, with the pain, with the loss, with the deafening, piercing regret that consumed his state of innocence and peace, ensuring he could never attain them again. If the only way for Zig to avoid all that was to erase those early years as a family, those moments of pure good, it wasn't a choice at all. He'd forever take the pain. He'd take all of it, easily. Sitting down in his favorite rusty lawn chair, Zig pulled out his phone and hit the button to dial a number. It rang once, twice.
"Please don't tell me you kissed her," Puerto Rican Andy answered. "You really think I'm that predictable?" "You told me she was coming over. Doesn't take a genius to guess the rest," Andy said. He lowered his voice. "Humans do have a knack of choosing precisely those things that are worst for them."
"That a Dumbledore quote?"
"All the best quotes are Dumbledore quotes. I'm proud of you, though. I thought for sure you'd screw it up."
The bees said.
Yeah, Zig said. "Anyway, just wanted to see how you're holding up." "You call twice a day. I'm doing okay."
It was a lie. Andy's voice was hoarse, his throat still healing.
"You up for a visit?" "Actually, if it's okay, Ziggy, can I rain check?"
He'd said the same yesterday and the day before that.
"I'm just not the best company right now."
"You know, Andy," Zig said, lowering his own voice, "happiness can be found, even in the darkest of times, if one only remembers to turn on the light."
"Son of a—"
Andy let out a laugh, a loud, rippling burst.
"You're doing Dumbledore to me? To me? You just Google that."
"Memorized it last week. Figured it'd come in handy. Now come on. I caused those stitches in your throat. Let me make up for it. I got a fancy present for you." The phone went silent.
"How fancy?"
"Balvenie 25-year, Zig said, glancing over at the crystal decanter sitting on a small three-legged plastic table that usually held a six-pack.
10 points to Gryffindor,"
Puerto Rican Andy yelled, even though it hurt to yell. It had hurt to drink scotch, too. After a beat, he added,
"You understand that means—"
"I know what it means," Zig interrupted, hopping from his chair, grabbing the crystal bottle by the neck and heading for the door.
"Let us step out into the night and pursue that flighty temptress adventure."
Guess who said that one? Harry, Ron, or Hermione?
"Ron?"
"Dumbledore, man. I told you, Dumbledore always gets the best quotes." Zig laughed as the bees buzzed behind him. "By the way, Andy, I was thinking about work," he said, stepping out into the night. "When you're ready for it, what are your thoughts about Delaware?"
Epilogue. Dulles, Virginia. It took patience to find him. Actually, that wasn't true. All it took was Nola's license plate, which gave him her car, which gave him her 2011 entry-level Dodge, an Avenger. From there, the Mopar system did the rest. tired of losing sales to LoJack, both Dodge and Chrysler introduced the Mopar tracking system in 2010, complete with silver and gold plans that gave you unlimited nationwide tracking for both location and speed. What most consumers didn't know, however, was that there was a base plan as well. No monthly fee, though good luck finding a dealer who'd tell you. As a result, to this day, there were tens of thousands of Dodge, Chrysler, and Jeep owners who had no idea their used cars were still sending trackable signals wherever they went. From there, all it took was patience and some friends in law enforcement. Fortunately, Roddy had both. "And he's been here how long?" Roddy asked. "I think at least..." Nurse Odessa flipped open the medical chart. She was a young, oval-faced Honduran woman with hazel eyes and a trim figure, like a runner. Yep. He got here when my son was born, nearly 2 years ago." Roddy nodded as they turned the corner in the empty, fluorescent-lit hallway. The only decorations were three framed portraits of white men in front of American flags: Secretary of Defense, Chief of Staff of the Army, and Sergeant Major of the Army. The photos were the only indication that this was a military facility. You'd never know it if you drove by. From the outside, the Fairfax Manor Rehabilitation Center was like every other forgettable glass and concrete office building this close to Dulles Airport. Designed to be overlooked, there wasn't even a sign out front. But again, Roddy knew where he was going. "That kind of day, huh?" Nurse Odessa asked, eyeing Roddy's police uniform and the federal warrant he was still holding in his hand. Roddy forced a grin that wasn't nearly as warm as he thought it was. As they headed down the hallway, he saw that most of the rooms were filled. On their right was a Saudi Arabian professor getting chemo and state-of-the-art treatment in exchange for information about a former student who now lived in Tehran. In another room was an Asian woman, an Army Ranger out of North Carolina, who'd had four of her fingers cut off when the Chinese government accused her, correctly, of being embedded in a robotics plant in Beijing. The U.S. government had facilities like this all over the globe. When undercover soldiers and secret squirrels make the wrong enemies, you can't just send them to emergency rooms or even military bases. Instead, you need a place that specializes in keeping them safe and out of sight. "Motley Crue?" Roddy asked, hearing the music at the end of the hallway. "Def Leppard," the nurse replied, as "Pour Some Sugar on Me" pounded in the distance. According to some doctors, or at least the ones at Fairfax Manor, the best way to help someone with a traumatic brain injury was to play songs that remind them of something they love. A reason to come back. "Apparently this was his band," Odessa explained, reaching the end of the hallway, room 113, as Def Leppard insisted they were sticky sweet from their head to their feet. "Yeah," Roddy whispered to himself, quickly pulling out his phone. No signal. No surprise. Of course the military blocked it here. Still, cell signals were different from GPS, which explained why, when Wags used Nola's phone to track her to various hospitals, it showed visits to three different patients in the past few weeks, all three with traumatic brain injuries. Otherwise, the patients had nothing in common. For Wags and Zig, it was the one unanswered question. Why was Nola talking to people with brain injuries? Naturally, Wags tried going back further. There were plenty of places Nola drove in the past few months, but when Nola had come here, her cell signal faded a few blocks away, just past a Cracker Barrel off the highway. At the time, Wags made a mental note, thinking Nola didn't seem like a Cracker Barrel type. But that was the end of it. As a result, Wags couldn't possibly know that instead of taking three car trips to three different patients, Nola had actually visited four. Roddy, though, thanks to the Mopar system, knew exactly where it was. Right here at Fairfax Manor. Patient Zero. The very first person Nola came to see. "Up and at 'em," Odessa announced, giving the door a shove. She didn't wait for a reply. Roddy knew there wouldn't be one. The room was dated, painted a tranquil blue-green with laminate wood floors, making it feel more like a 90s Pottery Barn catalog than a hospital suite. On the wall was a framed and faded poster with neon video game lettering that read, "Good health is contagious." Roddy didn't notice any of it. Trailing behind the nurse, he craned his neck at the unconscious man whose mouth sagged open like an empty Christmas stocking. Propped up in his hospital bed, he had gray hair that needed a buzz, a pitted face, and a faded scar that split his bottom lip in a zigzag from where it had been torn open years ago. "He looks old for liking Def Leppard," Roddy said. "Def Leppard's old," Odessa clarified. The song was still playing on a nearby sound dock, punctuated by a choir of beeps and buzzing from the respiratory monitor and various other machines, including a tracheostomy tube in the man's throat and a PEG feeding tube in his stomach. His legs were wrapped in compression stockings to prevent an embolism. His face was gaunt from losing at least 25 pounds, making him nearly unrecognizable. Keyword being nearly. The air in the room grew heavy, and Roddy felt a gash, a widened cut, like something was splitting him open. He recognized the man instantly. He remembered him, or at least a younger version of him from that night all those years ago. Back then, the man's hair was less gray, and he certainly didn't have the zigzag scar, but for Roddy, there was no forgetting that night, squinting down from the top of the stairs as the doorbell rang and this stranger stepped into their house to take Nola away. At the foot of the hospital bed, his name was written in faded black marker on a strip of white surgical tape. Royal Barker. "Royal," Roddy whispered, not even realizing he was saying it out loud. The closest thing Nola ever had to a father. He was supposed to be dead. 2 years ago, Nola uncovered him running a corrupt military unit. When he tried to kill her, she shot him in the head. Everyone said he was dead. And yet, here he was, hidden away, mouth agape, feeding tube pumping, as "Pour Some Sugar on Me" played on eternal repeat. "Nola, that's what you discovered, isn't it?" Roddy realized, snapping the last pieces into place. For a moment, Roddy stood there, rewinding, trying to make sense of why the military would hide the truth about Royal, much less help him. Were they trying to protect him? Or simply keep a lid on whatever embarrassing military secrets were still rolling around in his head? As the rewind picked up speed, Roddy replayed the past 2 years, trying to picture Nola's reaction when she realized Royal was alive. Did someone tell her? Or could she feel it? Something that big. You'd feel it, wouldn't you? Even here, even with Nola nowhere in sight, Roddy could sense an echo from her. He could feel his sister's rage, her fury at knowing that Royal, the ultimate cheater, had even cheated death. Yet none of that compared to what really had been driving Nola these past few months. Those visits Wags had been tracking, Nola's trips to various hospitals and patients. They had nothing to do with Mint or Grandma's pantry, nothing to do with Nola's anger or fury at the lies about Royal being alive. "That's your real secret, isn't it, sis?" Those visits Nola took were about something more fundamental in her life, the one thing she'd never admit even to herself. Despite the self-protective walls she'd erected, despite the exquisite rage, worn as armor to make her believe that she could take on anything, when it was late at night, in one of those quiet moments when the world made her feel like she was the only person still awake, there was still a little goblin lurking out there in the darkness that even the mighty Nola Brown was afraid of. The only goblin she'd ever been afraid of. The one she'd never been able to control. Royal himself. "That's why you went to see those victims with brain injuries." When it came to Royal, Nola was trying to answer the unanswerable questions. Will he be like this forever? Or is he going to wake up? which made Roddy wonder, if he does wake up, what is she planning to do? I take it he doesn't get many visitors, Roddy finally asked, studying Royal's open mouth, his cigarette-stained lower teeth like slanted books on a shelf. We don't do visitors. Just the one I told you about, the woman from the army. She came here once. We had to ask her to leave, and no offense, but since your warrant is limited to a quick ID, I need to ask the same of you. Yeah, of course. My apologies, Roddy said, still standing there, taking a last good look at Royal. On the nearby sound dock, Def Leppard sang that love was like a bomb and you should come and get it on. Roddy couldn't agree more. For years now, he'd thought about searching for Nola, trying to track her down, to reconnect, to learn a little bit about her, and he hoped, maybe, learn some more about himself. But the truth was, he never went through with it. It was the one white lie he told Zig. All these years, Roddy thought about looking for Nola, but he never did. Not until he had info about her, the most important her in his and Nola's life. Back behind the funeral home, Roddy tried telling Nola, but she wouldn't listen. Replaying their short conversation, Roddy wondered if maybe Nola didn't realize who he meant. But come on. She was the one person both Roddy and Nola cared about. In the end, that's what made him come searching for his sister. After years of digging, he'd finally found new info, an actual lead about what really happened when his and Nola's mother was murdered. Simply put, Roddy was searching for help. In the process, though, he'd found something far more important. He'd found insight. Now, when it came to Nola, he finally knew what was driving her. The only question was, what would he do with it? By the way, who told you he likes Def Leppard? Roddy asked. Excuse me? The music. Who told you Royal likes this music? He did, Odessa said, pointing toward the bed. Roddy cocked his head, confused. He woke up 2 weeks ago, the nurse added. Roddy turned just in time to see the breathing tube in Royal's neck start to shake as he blinked himself awake.
Who the hell are you?
Royal challenged, his voice an angry rasp as he covered the tracheostomy tube to speak. Me? Roddy asked, standing there, his spidery fingers excitedly touching his own chest.
I'm nobody.
This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Lightning Rod, a Zig and Nola novel by Brad Meltzer, presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2022 by 44 Steps Incorporated. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.